This is Jeff Blankford. My guest today, Pierre Laboissière, is a native of Haiti and co-founder of the Berkeley-based Haiti Action Committee. He has been working tirelessly for years on behalf of his homeland, trying to break through the wall of ignorance and disinformation surrounding Haiti that one finds in the mainstream media. He is also an old friend. Welcome, Pierre Laboissière, to Takes on the World.
Thank you so much, Jeffrey. And let me say this, what a beautiful, powerful anthem that calls us all to stand in solidarity with each other throughout the world. That's beautiful by Hollinier. Right on.
It's exactly. It is an anthem for our time. It should be our national anthem. When we spoke last night, you called my attention to the fact that this coming Saturday will be the 26th anniversary of the first coup against Jean-Bertrand Aristide, instigated by the first President Bush in 1991. How significant was that, and looking back a quarter of a century later?
Yes, very significant, and the memory of this coup is still very traumatic for the Haitian people. And this coup d'etat that took place on September 30th, and it lasted 3 years. And I have to say this to the public. Jeffrey, you were right there on the front lines with us, with the big solidarity movement that organized immediately to reverse the coup, and right here in the Bay Area. So I want to thank you for that and let people know that you are no stranger to Haiti yourself in terms of your work in solidarity.
Thank you.
This coup was very traumatic because Haiti had just a few years earlier, 4 years earlier, or five or so, had just come out from overthrowing the dictatorship of the brutal Duvalier family. We are talking about I know there are many young people who were not born around that time who may be listening. The president of Haiti, imposed by the U.S. in 1957, was a doctor, and his name was François Duvalier, but he was nicknamed Papa Doc. And he was put in office to brutally repress the very popular movement that had risen in Haiti, particularly in 1946, and really came out very strongly. So his role was to put down that movement, and he did it brutally with the help of a death squad known as the Tonton Macoutes, that was a militia that he had organized in addition to the Haitian military. So he passed away in 1971, but before he passed away, he named his 19-year-old son, Jean-Claude Duvalier, who became known as Baby Doc Duvalier. He made him president for life. And the brutality, the tortures, the disappearances continued by the dreaded Tonton Macoutes and also the Haitian military. And it took 1986 for the movement against the Duvaliers, very corrupt and deadly dictatorship, to be overthrown. But people overthrew. They were successful in overthrowing the dictator, but as one Haitian Egyptian brother stated, they didn't overthrow the dictatorship because the dictatorship had the full support of Washington and other European powers. They had backed it. So now we are talking about a 29-year-old dictatorship fully backed and supported by Washington and the European powers. And so 1990, for the very first time, and I'm skipping over a lot of the history here, the popular movement had organized itself in such a way and had managed to impose itself so that there would be free democratic elections in the country. A number of people had died before when the military had killed in 1987, when the first attempt at a democratic election had occurred. The Haitian military brutally killed people waiting in line to vote. There are videos about all of this on the internet. And Kevin Pina, in his film, Haiti, Harvest of Hope, has a lot of this footage. It's terrible what was done. So finally, people succeeded in electing the priest. He was a Roman Catholic priest, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, at the time Father Aristide, who used to do a lot of work with the poor, with the impoverished majority in Haiti, and had been known for denouncing the abuses of the dictatorship and courageously standing up to denounce them. And despite many attempts on his life, they weren't successful. He was elected president of the country. After 7 months in office, the Haitian military, and as you correctly stated, under the direction, under orders, actually, of the Bush administration, the first Bush administration, who the Haitians called Papa Bush, a reference to Papa Doc Duvalier, they overthrew, they carried out this brutal overthrow of President Aristide, this coup d'etat. It's estimated that over 5,000 people were massacred during that coup d'etat, and it lasted for 3 years, at the end of which the people were successful, and Father Aristide, at that time President Aristide, returned to Haiti. But he returned only to fulfill the last 14 months of a 5-year term. So only 7 months in office, brutal coup d'etat, and remaining with 14 months by the time he got back. So basically, but the changes that were put in motion during that period, because we are talking about a government of the people, so that meant people were participating in changing the wreck that Haiti had become under the corrupt Duvalier dictatorship, that in that span of time, even though the time was truncated, 7 months and then another period of 14 months, that people really, there was tremendous change and a sense of hope that the country finally was getting, was taking the first steps towards recovery. And I mean recovering from the brutal dictatorship, the destruction brought by the dictatorship, and really building a society that was looking at the Haitian people's needs rather than following the dictates of the big powers or the dictates of what we call the international imperialist powers who were imposing on Haiti. And Aristide was challenging that. He said, look, what you are proposing for us, such as the structural adjustment programs and other things, reduction for the government not to invest in hospitals, in health care for the people, in job creation. See, for example, Father Aristide, well, President Aristide wanted the minimum wage to be increased because that's what the people wanted. They couldn't live under those slave wages, if I may call it that, because slaves didn't get wages, but those wages, they were starvation wages. And so that was one of the reasons for the coup, because the business people in Haiti, mostly foreign factory owners, wanted to impose those wages. They had imposed them. And so he doubled the minimum wage, and that was a major reason for the coup. And so all of that was being done on his return. And so there was President Préval, who later on there was another transfer of power. There was an election, second democratic election, and Préval from the Lavalas party, at that time there was no Fermi Lavalas yet. There was the Lavalas movement. He had been Aristide's prime minister, and he was elected. And people had begun to organize. They continued their mobilization so that they could force the government. At that time, Haiti was occupied also. And people mobilized so that they could force the government of Préval to stay the course in terms of implementing a people's agenda. There was a lot of resistance from the government of Préval. See, before, when Aristide was in power, was the president, people didn't need to convince his administration that these things had to be done. They were moving aggressively on the agenda that people had prepared and put Aristide in the office of the presidency. But under Préval, he was giving way. He had begun to betray the movement of the people. And so people had to organize and take to the streets massively to force a number, an implementation of this people agenda. So by 2000, Aristide, who was eligible to run again for office, and was massively elected. Actually, he didn't win. People drafted him, both the first time and the second time. And it was on the 3 years into his second term as president, we are talking now 2004, that a second coup occurred in which he was in exile for 7 years. But the second coup was very bloody, if not bloodier. It's estimated that over 10,000 people were killed during that period of the coup and the UN occupation. So that, in short, is a short history of what the day today, this 25 years later, what this means for the people of Haiti and why they are mobilizing to say no to coup d'etats, to say that the resistance, they have never stopped resisting, that the current government in Haiti is a government that's an occupation government. It was imposed by the occupation. The people have never voted for it, and people are there to challenge it because the conditions in the country, after 13 years of a United Nations occupation, the conditions of the country, the misery, is unparalleled the way from what we had experienced before. It's overwhelming what's going on, and overwhelming in a very terrible sense.
My guest is Pierre Lavoisier, and we were talking about Haiti and the significance of past President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. One thing Aristide did that upset the United States was he disbanded the army, and now there's an attempt to bring it back.
That's correct. The army in Haiti, and one of the four people who want to bring back the Haitian army, they say, well, this was the glorious army that won independence, the country's independence, in 1804, over 200 years ago. But they know that it's a lie, because that army was a people's army. In 1804, when our foremothers and forefathers rebelled against slavery and started the Haitian Revolution, what is now called the Haitian Revolution, with an uprising of the enslaved Africans in 1791, and after a 13-year period of mobilization, rebellion, revolution, fighting against the powers of France, Britain, and Spain, successfully defeating them, that our enslaved African foremothers and forefathers succeeded in kicking out some of the best troops of Napoleon out of Haiti. And so that army was a people's army, and they were not created to repress and oppress their people. It was the people defending their land, breaking the chains of slavery, and declaring themselves an independent nation. Very different, revolutionary army. What has now been the Haitian army, which was disbanded by President Aristide, came out of the U.S. occupation of 1915. The U.S. occupied Haiti from 1915 until 1934. And that army, they built an army so that when they left in 1934, that army would continue the work of oppressing and repressing the Haitian people. And that army, actually, that they built, was built to fight the people's resistance. There were many resistance fighters known as the CACOs. They were Haitian peasants who were resisting the U.S. military implementation during the occupation of land expropriation. They were taking away their land so that they could give them to promote big plantation agriculture. And many of the peasants, their ancestors had fought for the land, and now they were losing it. And they couldn't feed their families, so they rebelled against the occupation. And so over 20,000, it's been estimated that over 20,000 Haitian resistance peasants were killed during this occupation, causing many of them a big mass exodus of people from Haiti being chased away from their land into countries such as the Dominican Republic and Cuba, where they ended up working for being exploited in the sugarcane plantation. So, as you can see, it was the displacement of people that we are experiencing today, same as the wars of Central America caused many of our brothers, Central American brothers and sisters, to be forced them to leave their homeland. Well, the same thing was occurring during that period, so that their land could be taken away. And that's one of the, you see, when we look at the whole issue of migration and forced migration, it's really displacement, taking away people's resources so they have no choice but to leave their homeland under threat of death.
You're making a very good point that most Americans here don't appreciate. Leaving one's homeland, leaving one's village is not an easy decision. And usually for those forced to leave, they end up working in far more difficult conditions than they would ordinarily have to work in their own homeland if they were allowed to do that. You had the situation, of course, in the Dominican Republic, which is Haiti's neighbor, where 200,000 Haitian Dominicans were lost their citizenship because the Dominican Republic has been collaborating with the United States over the years. Maybe you could talk about that as well.
Yes, and that's a segue into that from what I was saying earlier. So many of the brothers and sisters who ended up during the 20s in the wake of the U.S. occupation having to flee to the Dominican Republic and Cuba and other places such as the U.S. and other islands, you know, because they were being severely repressed and many of their folks had been killed and their land taken over. So they ended up in the Dominican Republic. And according to the Dominican Constitution, when you are born in the Dominican Republic, you are a Dominican citizen. But there was a whole history, which we may not get into given the time constraints, about racism being promoted in the Dominican Republic, a racist attitude. They wanted the country to become, they were encouraging European immigration to make the country more white. You see, and so the Haitians coming in, though they wanted their labor, their labor is never cheap, it's just exploited. But they wanted to exploit their labor, but that's all they wanted them to be. For the same reason that our ancestors were kidnapped from Africa so they could work for free for somebody, you know, to make somebody rich. Well, the same thing they wanted, but they didn't want the Haitians there who had been born, whose parents had come over, and many of them were born and were Dominicans by birth. And so the Dominican court passed a new law saying that they were stripping the citizenship of everyone who, from 1926 on, you see, unless you could prove that your someone prior, before that time, you know, was born in the Dominican Republic and what have you. So it was a very racist position, a very racist law that they pushed to the, which is not in their constitution. And so there was a big outcry about this. But there is also an economic basis for that. When you're a citizen in a country, for example, in the Dominican Republic, you have certain advantages too, such as pension, such as free education or other benefits, social benefits that come from that. And also the fact that you're rooted in the land, it means that you know your rights and you're a citizen. You can speak out. You can organize more freely and with your fellow neighbors, with your brothers and sisters who are also Dominicans. But by making someone automatically, quote-unquote, illegal, right, and I'm using their term, basically you take away their citizenship rights and their determination. You chip away their determination to be able to stand up and say, no, I won't tolerate this. I'm going to form a union. I'm going to take to the streets. Now they have to always be on the lookout for La Migra, for the immigration officers, you see? So it's a cynical. And then the benefits that they should have had, now that they are nearing, that they are close, that they are in retirement, you suddenly are taking away those benefits from them. So it's a theft. Not only did you exploit their labor, but you are taking away the benefits that they should have for all the many years of hard work that they have put in the fields. and in other areas of labor. So you see, that is not spoken about as well. And that was the move that the Dominican Republic, that the court system, the Superior Court, took in, I believe, 2013.
Well, this has been, you have a situation where Haitian immigrants have been exploited and abused. We have Haitian immigrants in Tijuana who worked in Brazil, were brought to Brazil during the Olympics, and are kind of stuck in refuge in camps outside in Mexico. You have Haitians in the United States who may be returned, who are being allowed to stay in the United States as a result of the earthquake. And what's going to happen to them, they don't even know.
Exactly, exactly. And by contrast, let me say this, and what I wanted to add to this, the situation is very different for Haitians who are in Cuba, you see, because many of them also went under those similar circumstances to Cuba. But when the revolution took place, the revolution in Cuba has a respect for people, didn't look down on the Haitians who were working in the sugarcane plantations, but they lifted them up. The Cuban Revolution exalted, promoted, and gave recognition and status to the cane workers. And so today, many of them, they have dual citizenship, Cuban-Haitian citizenship, you see, which Cuba gave them the Cuban citizenship. And so there is much more respect. Their kids go to school. They don't have to worry about this whole situation, which, and I'm making this contrast with a socialist country and how the revolution changed this issue compared to what's going on, what has gone on with Brazil, with Haitians in Brazil. And I'm glad you raised that, because what has happened, those very same conditions since the coup of 2004, the brutal coup d'etat, Brazil was given the job. So the U.S., France, and Canada did the coup d'etat of 2004. They were the ones who organized it. The Ottawa Initiative in Canada actually brought together the U.S., France, Canada, and representatives of the European Union. But those three were the ringleaders. And so after they sent the troops to kidnap President Aristide, and it was special forces from the U.S., and later on, at the same time, French and Canadian troops landed in Haiti, and they secured an authorization from the Security Council to hide, to make as if to legalize that highly illegal action, that criminal action. So next thing that they did was they put together this fig leaf of the UN. And who did they get? Socialist Lula from Brazil, and who was actually in charge of the what they called the multinational force, and other socialist governments in South America who lent their troops to be part of this multinational force, calling themselves peacekeepers, but their mission was to make sure that the coup that was initiated by the U.S., France, and Canada, that it was successful. And they started repressing the population. There is video footage of a number of massacres that these troops, particularly Brazilian troops, Jordanian troops, conducted against the people in Haiti. The footage is there. And about this, and there is a video, it's called What's Going On in Haiti. And Kevin Pina has a film called Haiti, We Must Kill the Bandits, using the phrase that was used during the first occupation of 1915 and making the link with the current occupation. So as a result, many of our brothers and sisters were forced to flee Haiti. And as usual, you had the situation of a socialist country like Brazil using the misery of our people to bring them to Brazil so that they could work on the Olympic Village at exploitative wages, you see, to undermine the labor movement in Brazil. And this is what it is all about. And unfortunately, not too many of our brothers and sisters in these countries are able to grasp how we are being used against each other. Some did. Some took a strong position, but not enough so as to force Brazil to, number one, stop the killing of our brothers and sisters, and two, to remove itself from this occupation. And the same situation. Right now, we have the spectacle. You mentioned the Haitian army. Ecuador and Brazil have been training the so-called new Haitian army, which is nothing but these the same old killers who are trying to restore themselves and bringing up some a younger generation into this killing machine that the Haitian killing, corrupt, drug-promoting machine, narco-trafficking promoting machine that the Haitian military is and has been known to be. So that's what we are seeing. So you have, and the Haitian people are so outraged and disappointed. I am outraged and disappointed that countries who call themselves socialists, who have come under, who have been the victims of dictatorship, just like the people of have made themselves accomplices of this, of a right-wing, repressive government, a project of the most despicable imperialist countries of this world.
And you're right that many people, the majority of people who claim to be on the left and progressive, look the other way because what they would see is not very pretty, and looking the other way means you don't have to do anything or say anything. And this, unfortunately, has been the case with Haiti for so many years. You know, when years ago we did an interview, and I said, we talked about the fact that the world, the dominant world, the white supremacist world, European, American world, has never forgiven Haiti for overthrowing the French in 1804, and have made Haitians pay not only with their lives but also with their money to even repay France for overthrowing their colonies and made France rich. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Yes, that's correct. And this is what has happened is after Haiti became an independent nation, Haiti was surrounded by slave-owning countries that whose economies, you know, they were colonialist powers, and they were slave-holding whose economies and wealth, not just economy, their wealth, their fabulous wealth, depended on slavery. And so for to have African and slave Africans, our foremothers and forefathers, because the women were very involved in that struggle, according to historians and including French officers who had to face these women in battle. So they were part of it. They were great leaders of the movement. So what happened was they all supported the French demands that there be reparations to the former slave owners, and I put that in quotes, for their losses. What was their loss? It was not only the land, no, but it was the people who were their former slaves, and that's what it was. So people in Haiti didn't accept it. The government at the time that accepted this and accepted, I have to put it in quotes, even though it was it had become a government, what we'd call today like a neo-colonial government, but that government was resisting. But the threat was, unless this was done, that Haiti would be, quote-unquote, annihilated, just destroyed by these combined big powers. And so another thing, too, because at that time slavery was the thing taking place all, everywhere, that Haitian citizens could be kidnapped and put into slavery. So given those threats, the Haitian government at the time folded and fought and signed that under duress, this, you know, that we have to pay. And it and the amount was over $21 billion, close to $22 billion from 1826 until 1947. Haiti had to pay that quote-unquote debt. They call it in Haitian history books, the Death of Independence, but that's how they call it. They refer to it, but we should really call it a ransom that we had to pay. And so one of the things that they, it wasn't, when we look at today, it or during that time, bringing it to today, it wasn't so much as a way of punishing, but it was also at that time because Haiti was unabashedly strong in denouncing colonialism, in denouncing slavery, and let everybody know who was enslaved anywhere in the world that Haiti would be a sanctuary for them, that they could come to Haiti and they would no longer be slaves, that they would be free human beings, and Haiti would protect their freedom and let every nation in this world know that. And Haiti, in addition to that, made itself known as being a supporter of everyone in the Americas or everyone who was fighting against colonialism. And as a result, Simon Bolivar came to Haiti, Miranda before, and later on Simon Bolivar came to Haiti in the 1810, somewhere there. Since 1805, they had been coming. That was Miranda and later on Simon Bolivar, when he was defeated fighting Spanish colonialism. He came, he landed in my hometown of Lekai. He landed there the first time and landed in Jacmel the second time. And each time, Haiti gave him ships, weapons, ammunition, and volunteers, people who had already fought the Spanish in Haiti, who knew their tactics. And they went with him to train his army and to fight. And Haitian blood was spilled in those countries of South America. And the second time, Bolivar was successful. Also, Haiti declared itself, Haiti was known as Freedom Land for many of the other Caribbean colonies in the Caribbean of these colonialist powers. And people would flee a lot and come to Haiti. People would leave the U.S. Africans enslaved in the U.S. would leave to come to Haiti. So Haiti was a nightmare for the slavocracy, I would put it that way.
Including the United States.
This government that believe in slavery in the U.S., Haiti was a nightmare for it. And their goal was to annihilate Haiti, to destroy Haiti, to make sure Haiti would never grow as a nation and prosper. And the same thinking is going on today. I know many people praise Thomas Jefferson as a great Democrat, but we, when you look at his position on Haiti, he wanted Haiti to be destroyed, and he actually helped finance the French, Napoleon, so he could restore slavery in Haiti. So the whole dream, even going as late as 1860, the whole dream of the southern Dixiecrats, or the including the, some of the northern who believe who are making their money off of the slavery in the south, they wanted Haiti to be taken over by the U.S. so slavery could be restored. So it's an ongoing situation, and what we are seeing today, they look at the land as a land. Haiti has a lot of riches. Number one, the resources, the natural resources of the place. It's a beautiful piece of land, and also very strategically located. And Haiti has a lot of petroleum underneath. Haiti has uranium and iridium and gold and silver. So a lot of that, they want to plunder it, like in the days of the conquistadors. But they couch it under, they want to take it over, but they give you terms like, oh, the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere, we are their heart bleeds, and we want to help the poor Haitians. But at every opportunity, be it the earthquake, be it the recent storms that have hit Haiti, that's another opportunity. Even the misery of our people has become a gold mine for these rapacious imperialists to make money off of our people. And that's what's going on today. That's why today people are in the streets of Haiti. People have been rising up against the occupation, against the occupation government of Jovenel Moïse. Relentless, been nonstop. Every time they are imposing these things on the people of Haiti, they have never stopped. We don't see that in the Western media. We don't see that, I should say better, in the corporate media, let's call it what it is. We don't see that. And unfortunately, not as much in the progressive media as another area of this world where people are rising up to fight the powers of these greedy, imperialist, rapacious.
And Pierre, this is we've covered so much of the history, which I think is really important for people to understand. We're going to have to come back and interview you again about what is going on in Haiti. I want to thank you so much for being our guest today and filling in this very important information on a part of our history, because the United States' role and in keeping Haiti what it is today has been very severe and significant. So thanks for being our guest today on Takes on the World, brother.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Let me just give people our website,
yes,
if I may,
please
real
do.
Quick.
Yes.
It's HaitiSolidarity.net. That's the website of the Haiti Action Committee. We're also on Facebook as Haiti Action Committee Facebook. There is also a play that's being done to benefit the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund this Saturday at 7:30 p.m. at the Omni Commons in Oakland. But you'll see that when you get on the on the website. The announcement is there.
Well, thanks so much. Take care, Pierre, and keep fighting, keep on keeping on. Take
Thank
care.
You, my brother.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks very much for listening.